everyone. Welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
All right. We've got a bunch of new stories. Thank you so much to the listeners, by the way. You guys have been sending us some killer, dumb crime, stupid criminals stories that are just out of this world. It worries me on a daily basis, Tim, to realize that you and I out in public are walking amongst these people on a regular.
Oh, yes.
The sheer stupidity and lunacy of some of these people, and it never, never ceases to amaze me. Every time I think there's no way people could get any dumber, Tim, we get stories like we've got today.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze, does it?
No. But thank God for dumb people, especially when they're in other states. I don't like all the criminals in our state. And I do look, I want you to know, that I do seek out dumb crimes and stupid criminals in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And either they're just amazingly stealthy at it, or our news outlets are just too Minnesota nice to cover it. So we just don't hear that many.
They could be very nice, and they're choosing to put it in the background so we don't hear about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I want like the tater tot hot dish robber. Why can't we come up with a cool character like that out here?
I think because we defend our tater tot hot dish way too well.
Lutefisk larceny. That's what we should write the book, Tim.
Well, anybody can have lutefisk. I mean, they could take it if they want it.
You give it away, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into the meat of today's story. Social media. I mean, there's no doubt, Tim, that we have seen a very strange rise in violent attacks and murder, abuse that is posted blatantly online. I mean, you even have criminals, as we've done on Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals segments, going on and taunting the police on their page and essentially leading the police right to where they are. But social media has kind of taken down the barriers of social protocol, I don't know. I mean, it's just so bizarre. And then you hear more and more of these crimes that kind of play out. And we've seen video. We've seen people streaming themselves as they attack others, whether it's to kill or just to maim. It's gotten out of hand. And, you know, I know that they've put things in place now on social media outlets to try to keep a better eye on it. But yet we still hear these stories leak through. And that's what brought my attention to a new book, My Son, the Killer, The Untold Story of Luke Magnotta. And One Lunatic, One Ice Pick. Brian Whitney is our guest today to talk to us about this very bizarre, tragic case. Brian has been a prisoner advocate, a landscaper, and a homeless outreach worker. He's written or co-authored numerous books and has been featured or appeared on Inside Edition, Fox News, People.com, True Murder, and True Crime Garage. He's written for Alternet, Pacific Standard Magazine, Paste Magazine, and many other places. He's also appearing at CrimeCon in 2019. Brian, thank you so much. I know you're about to head out of town to New Zealand, so thank you for squeezing us in before you make that long trek.
Hey, you guys. Thanks so much. I appreciate having me on.
Before we get into this story particularly, you know, I know that there's a lot of stories that go under the wire. The same kind of volatile nature, murder, attacks, and we don't hear anything about it. But what makes some of these stories, do you think, leap from our social media pages and capture the attention while others seem to go completely unnoticed?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if I could actually, I could answer that. I'm working
okay,
on
well,
a book
thank
right
you very
now.
Much and have a good rest of your night.
I'm working on a book right now with a guy named Rob Dick, who is one of the bail bondsmen in the Casey Anthony case. That he was one of the guys that bailed Casey Anthony like out of jail and so on. And he was saying to me the other day, he was like, I have no idea why this case, out of all others, meaning Casey Anthony, became so, you know, incredibly famous when there are other cases, tragically, all the time, where mothers might harm their children or their children go missing and no one ever hears about it. I mean, there's some sort of thread that somebody picks up on it and someone else picks up on it. I mean, it just goes viral, and I'm not sure if I can actually identify what delineates one from the other in these situations. Other than, of course, the case that we're talking about with Luca, where it's pretty obvious why.
Right. But now here's an interesting aspect, because we talk a lot on the show about, you know, we did a show last week on JonBenet Ramsey. Okay. And here is this beautiful little girl who was taken away much too soon. Unfortunately, right. there are There are children of color that die on a daily basis that don't garner one millionth of the attention that JonBenet Ramsey
did. Very good point. Very good point.
And then you've got, so it's easy to say, you know, media seems to cling to white, you know, upper class or middle class victims because it's, you know, that's who the attention of their audience or their advertising buying share will bring in. But in this case, this one even kind of flies in that face of logic because the victim in this case is not, you know, a privileged white girl. You know, this is a different story altogether. Do you think? And I remember when the story broke and I remember just sitting back horrified thinking, my God, and this was posted. This was on social people saw this.
Have you seen it?
No, I didn't. I avoid, you know.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. And I mean,
I have kids and daughters, and that when it comes to that, I just can't stomach the idea of watching that happen.
Yeah. I understand. No,
reading
I didn't
about
like
it, hearing the story afterwards is one thing, but to visually watch what took place, I don't understand people's affinity for that. But let's talk about Luca. Talk to me about him prior to this scenario. What was he like growing up? What was his family dynamic like?
Well, I mean, what makes this book a little bit interesting is that it's kind of written in tandem with Luca's mother, where she writes a chapter and then I kind of write a chapter from more of a journalistic view. And I mean, he was mentally ill. I mean, in my opinion, I mean, I think in other people's opinion, he may not have been, including his mother, but he grew up in a very typical, well, not totally typical, but a middle-class environment where he in theory may have suffered some abuse as a child. He has been diagnosed with schizophrenia numerous times. He's homosexual. He was teased. He was picked on. So he didn't have a happy childhood, I would say.
You know, there are a lot of us that didn't. I was, you know, beat up on a regular growing up. You know, I for 4 years, I was kind of the whipping boy because I put myself in that position. You know, and my father, I was more afraid of my dad than I was the kids at school. And my dad did not want to be bothered to have to come pick me up if I got detention. He just wanted me home after school. My dad said, you get in a fight, you cause problems, you're going to have to deal with me when you get home. Now, I know that sounds abusive on the outside, but it was teaching me respect and that my actions didn't just affect me, but it affected the people at the school. It affected his schedule. So I towed the line, but I took a lot of abuse for four years. And, you know, it's not to say that at times in my life, that little voice hasn't been, hey, let's just run this son of a bitch off the road. It's there. It's there in all of us at one point. But I, you know, the trigger mechanism is not there. I don't pull that trigger. In this case, he led not such a great life, but what, you know, was there a point in his life? Was there a catalyst? Or do you think it was just, as you said, you think there was already a mental issue in play and then you heap the rest of this on it and it just collapsed like a house of cards?
Well, what makes Luca's case so interesting to me and you know, I wasn't a writer when it happened. And I remember, like a lot of people were being kind of blown away by the actual act itself that he did, but there were all sorts of signs that he was deteriorating for a very long period of time. I mean, and he did some things that were relatively monstrous. But he'll deny these, by the way. I mean, I should be clear that I interviewed him for this book over the phone and in writing. So when I say certain things like he did something, I should be clear and say Luca has said that if you read the book, he'll say that he didn't. But there were videos that were posted before involving kittens that were very disturbing, and PETA was, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals were kind of chasing after him. He would pretend to be all sorts of different people on social media. He supposedly had, again, he denies this, and I'm being clear about that, but he supposedly had like 80 or so accounts, social media accounts, that he would sort of argue with himself and sort of build himself up. He pretended that he was dating Kyla Homolka, who was the Canadian serial killer who was released. Lots of really, really bizarre social media things that would lead one to believe that he certainly was not a well person, even if you would not think that he would eventually do what he did.
Wait, so he was making claims that he was in a relationship with a serial killer?
Yeah, kind of to like pump himself up. And Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka were a pair of Canadian serial killers. And Paul is still in prison, and Carla was his girlfriend, and she was released. And Luca would, again, he denies this, but it's pretty much proven to be true that Luca would, he was pretending on social media that he was dating Carla, like they were together, so to speak.
So he's looking for yeah. the attention, obviously. He's looking obviously. For some kind of rise in royal. Now, was he,
right.
you said that he was estranged from his mother. At what point did that take place in his life?
Well, at one point, it was after the videos with the kittens, because people started contacting his mother and saying, I think Luca has been.
All right, well, real bad for people that aren't familiar with this story. Talk to us about the video. What did he
do? Oh, yes. Yeah, I don't even know. These videos, like, I'm the kind of person that, you know, I write true crime, and you were talking about. I write true crime, and obviously I'm very concerned with rights of victims and so on and so forth. When it comes to animal stuff, I mean, I have a hard time with it. I have a really hard time with it. So I don't even like talking about this stuff. But anyway, he put up some videos. Again, he'll deny it, but he put up some videos where he basically did things to suffocate kittens and things of that nature online. And after that, it caused quite an uproar. Again, PETA was offering rewards. People were looking for him. Reporters were contacting him and asking if he was the person doing this and so forth. And it was a really bizarre scene. So his mother got wind of this and was concerned, obviously, and he denied doing it, even though she could see him in the video and was like, that's you, you know? So they kind of became estranged for a while, as a lot of mothers would in a scenario.
Really? And how old was he at that point?
Oh, man. I mean, I won't be able to tell you exactly, but I'm saying he was in his early 20s.
And instead of, I don't know, here's my deal. I've got kids that spread the gamut, and, you know, I've got 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds. And if I saw them hurting an animal on video, I think estrangement would be the last thing. I would be injecting myself more into their lives to try to make sure that they weren't about to jump the rails. What made her kind of decide to step back? Did she feel that there was an imminent threat to her safety as well?
She did talk to the police about it, about the situation with the cats, the kittens. And then also he at that time was very adamant that he didn't want to speak to her because of her questioning about the situation. So he was kind of the one at the time. They didn't live really close by. He was the one that kind of dropped off the map. And he also, he would say things like, oh, I'm living in Los Angeles, or I'm living in Russia. Like, that was the other thing that he would do, even though he was still just in Canada. So I think that she just didn't know what to do at that point. It's a very bizarre case, obviously.
Yeah,
like,
no
just
doubt.
Even talking to you about it, not like, you know, just kind of describing the circumstances leading up to it. It's not like a, you know, we haven't even gotten to the thing.
Right.
Now, the actual murder, you know.
Had he shown violent outbursts toward people growing up, aside from the occasional fist fight, which we all go through?
No, he one way, didn't. Shape, or I mean, another. He did not. In fact, he was bullied. So he did not, to my knowledge anyway, from anything I've read through my research, anyone's ever said, he did not show any violent impulses.
So this really did kind of, even though we saw the boiling under the lid with the cat videos, this still seems way out of line for who he was and what he would be capable of, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that's sort of like, until someone does something like that, I mean, I think it's sort of out of line almost for anybody where you think somebody would be would be capable of.
No, I don't know about that. Tim and I have known some people through the years.
Yeah.
You look at him and you talk to him enough and you're like, you know, that's the kind of guy I want to know where he is at all times so that I don't ever find him knocking on my door.
Good point. Yeah, no, I get your point there. Now, you're right in that context. I mean, he was a skinny guy. Like, he was a model, like, not as successful as he pretended to be. He pretended to be a very successful model, and he wasn't. But he was a male escort. He was a model. He would dance in clubs as a stripper, and he was a very skinny, you know, a little bit effeminate guy that you would not necessarily look at as a threat to harm you. If you just met him.
Sure. Now, the days leading up to this crime, anything unusual surface now that we can look back at it with, you know, 2020 hindsight?
Well, he started like putting up, it's all internet stuff. He started putting up videos that were proven to be him later, where he was sort of like inferring that there was going to be a video. He would put up videos or leave comments places and say, has anyone seen, the video One Lunatic, One Ice Pick. And so he was referring to the act before he actually did it, but there would still be no reason that anyone would think anything of it, you know, when he actually did that. But in hindsight, there were signs.
So he was teasing this all along. And how many days in advance was that?
You know, I'll probably be off a little bit here, so I shouldn't say exactly, but I mean, it was within like a month to a few weeks beforehand that things like that were popping up on the internet from him.
Okay. Now, you know, I always feel that it's hard to tell these stories without talking about the killer and giving them the spotlight, which is sick, but you know, it's important also to understand where this person came from and why. But now let's talk about the victim before this unimaginable horror took place. Tell me about her.
Yeah. Well, it was actually a guy, you know, so the victim is a man named Yun Lin, who's from China originally and came to America to study at a school in Canada. I can't remember the name of the college, but he was a college student. And he wasn't anybody that Luca knew. He met him online.
But what was his life? What was his life then before this? I mean, was he good student, good person? You know, was he running in wrong circles, drug addict?
I mean, he's from China, and he was a gay man, and he was closeted in China, came to Canada, was thought of as a nice guy. He had a boyfriend that he broke up with, or that broke up with him. I'm not clear on that. Maybe a few months before he met Luca, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying, because in all these situations, I mean, one gives so much attention to the perpetrator of the crime, and quite often the person, you know, that is the victim is, you know, is ignored. You know, his father, spoke at the trial and gave a victim statement, and from what I know, I mean, he's a very nice young man. It was just interested in exploring his sexuality, and happened to come across the wrong person to do that with.
Was his father or any family member aware of his lifestyle and choices, or was this all kind of, man, when you pull the curtain back, everything came out?
I believe it was a surprise to them, because I believe that was a big part of the reason that he came to Canada in the first place, was because his family and his country and his lifestyle situation was something that was not likely to be welcomed. So I believe that's why he came to Canada in the first place. Now, when I speak to him, though, to be fair, I have researched him and I wrote about him in the book, but I'm definitely not an expert on his life like I know about Luca, but I believe that's the situation.
Okay. Now, how do these two come into each other's lives?
they met, and that's the thing. And when I say that about not having as much detail on him is because Luca didn't know him either. I mean, they met through a Craigslist ad to get together and hang out, in theory, to have a sexual encounter.
So Craigslist ad. Okay. So it was one of those personal ads and they
one of those personal ads, like, you know, let's get together tonight and hang out and see what happens kind of ads. But it was definitely more sexually, the ad itself was bondage was mentioned and things like that were mentioned. So it wasn't just like a, hey, let's go out for coffee. I mean, it was implied that they were going to have sex like in the ad. So they meet, they basically meet like at a subway station and they go back to Luca's apartment. Luca wasn't much of a partier, but this guy, like, Yanlin wanted to like drink a little bit. So they just had a glass of wine or two. And see, this is when, I mean, if you know anything about the case, like, so like at this point, like no one really knows exactly what happened. All you really have is the video. And then you have what Lucas said, and then you have evidence of what happened afterwards. But so this stuff is all known, but as far as what led up to the actual video that you can see, it's kind of unclear because Luca would be the only one that would be able to tell you that.
Right.
You know?
Okay. So they meet up, they connect. Do they actually end up having relations or...
In theory, they did. I mean, the victim was naked and tied up at the beginning of the video. And this is one of the things, too, because, you know, even if you were to say, which I don't think you will, but even if you were to say, and I'm laughing because it's uncomfortable, not because if you were to say, oh, Brian, like, you know, what happened in the video? I honestly can't really. It's so wild and bad that you know, I could give, if you'd like, I could give some parameters of what happened. But I mean, the end result is that, I mean, the video starts where the victim is just tied and blindfolded to the bed. And then just all these incredibly horrific things happen, to the person, and he's videotapes himself doing all these things. That are just unimaginable, really.
Is there any, and, aside from what I would guess would be pleading and crying for their lives, is there any explanation given, any conversation from Luca of what's going on or why?
No, there's actually no pleading or crying either. I mean, because it's a bondage situation, like, you know, in the ad, it was implied that there would be bondage. So the victim was tied up and blindfolded, and then there's just, then it just sort of just like happens. Like, you know, he wasn't aware that this was going to happen to him.
Oh man. So it was the perfect spider web.
Right. Exactly. So you realize
you're going to be a part of this sexual game and that you're going to be, you know, tied up, maybe gagged, and this is all part of the game. Exactly. And basically what you've done is just set yourself up for the perfect kill.
Exactly. Like, there was no situation where it was like he was overpowered or anything like that. He was tricked, you know? So, and then again, I don't know how much, you know, and I'm not going to get into detail, but, and then afterwards, numerous things are done to the corpse that are just absolutely unbelievable, that are also filmed. You know, so it's like, even talking about it to you on a podcast for a book that I wrote, it makes me uncomfortable. You know, it's a very uncomfortable thing to watch. I mean, I would recommend, if there are people listening to this, that you don't watch it, to be honest, because you still can find it on the internet. You know, it's very, 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 it's a very disturbing video. I would say without a doubt, it's the most disturbing thing I've ever seen.
Did that make writing this book even harder to do? Because I've got to guess, when you write true crime, and you kind of immerse yourself in these stories, there's got to, you know, we've talked to some authors who it's just a big ick factor. And afterwards, it takes a long time for them to try to.
Yeah. I mean, I used to do, I used to work as a prisoner advocate for the ACLU, and I used to do like homeless outreach and stuff. And so I have like a lot of background in dealing with some pretty odd people. And then I got into, this is just a quick, I'm not going to digress too much, but I got into this kind of the true crime thing. I wrote a book with Gil Valley, who was known as the cannibal cop, who was actually exonerated and never actually committed a crime and so on and so forth. But because of that book had a modicum of success, like then I was able to sort of like angle it into some other decent true crime job. So this one is because I talked to Lucas. So like I'm talking to the guy on the phone, you know, and he's a charming guy. And I'm not a judgmental person at all, is what I was sort of, which was how why I was telling you those other facts in my background. But it's difficult. I mean, it's definitely difficult because it's just like whole, you know, like like you know, you're talking to someone on the phone, you're communicating with them, and then you watch the video, and it's like, man, I wish I did not. I thought about like, man, maybe I could write this without watching the video. And I was like, yeah, no, that's not gonna fly. You know, so
now is there a sense of desensitization? Oh God, I can't even say the word is jumbling up in my mouth. But are you desensitized to it? Because we've grown up now in the last 20, 30 years with shows like Saw and Hostel, and you know, right, movies that are so graphically violent, watching horrific ways for people to die. When you see something like that, are you kind of disconnected from it because of how, you know, and when I watched the scene of 9/11 and the towers coming down and the smoke,
yeah,
it to me was like Roland Emmerich's, you know, Godzilla, you know, as I watched him come through the city, right, and clouds, it was so surreal and unreal. It was like, it wasn't that I wasn't impacted by what I was watching, but it felt like Hollywood magic and that I wasn't watching something really happen. When you're watching a video like that, is that the same scenario for you?
I do know what you mean. And there was some sense of it being surreal just because what continued to go on. I think it's like about a, you know, a 10, 11, 12 minute video, and it's edited, you know, it's like, so as it continues to go on, there's a lot of different things going on. It almost becomes so much that you're just like, okay, it does become a little bit desensitizing. But I think it's just that I've never seen anything. And again, I'm a guy that's got a background that's a lot more, I guess. It's, you know, I've met people that have killed people before when they did the prisoner job, and like I've worked with a lot of fairly odd people writing and so on and so forth, but it still weirded me out. You know, I didn't feel particularly desensitized to it at all, to be honest.
So you watch this video, and I know you're cautious on how you talk about this. Does it go through, does it stay on through the dismembering?
Yeah, oh yeah, no, it definitely does. I mean, I don't have to be cautious. I just think that when, you know, this video is so bad. I wrote a book at one time, like called, it was a book of interviews that I did, and it's called Subversive, and it was published by a publisher in England called Head Press. And ironically enough, I interviewed a guy named Mark Merrick, who he owns a website called bestgore.com that this video was posted on. And the video is so bad that Mark went to jail for 6 months for posting the video. You get what I'm saying?
Right.
Like it's, you know, the guy that put the video on his website ended up being incarcerated. You know, that's how graphic the video is. It was for corrupt. He went to jail for corrupting morals was the charge that he received. Mark, that's what I'm talking about now. So
right. Yes,
it goes through a variety of different stages of dismemberment and some sexual activity that's actually, a lot of it seems is actually kind of faked, which makes it even more bizarre. There's simulated sexual activity but the pants seem to be still on and things of that nature. So it makes it even odder because it's kind of like, okay, you did this just kind of for show, not because of some really awful sexual desire, Right. You get what I mean?
Right.
Almost makes it worse in some weird way.
Yeah.
Not really, but I mean, just more confusing. So yeah.
Now, did you say during the video, does Luca speak at all? Is he saying anything or is it just violence?
No, he doesn't speak. Oh my God, I can't remember the name of the song. And that was a New Order song playing in the background. Like, I mean, it's like edited, you know?
Oh, okay.
So he actually has a soundtrack to it, you know? So no, he doesn't speak and you can't tell it's him for quite a while. But there are some shots where you can clearly see him later in the video.
Okay.
He's kind of got a mask on where his eyes are just like sticking through them.
He attacks with a kitchen knife and an ice pick, does his damage. Then, as if that's not enough, he dismembers this person.
Yeah.
And then he tells what happens with the body parts that he took from this man.
You mean afterwards?
Right.
Well, a big part of the reason that, because again, he'll say, or he does say that he doesn't like talking about this, interestingly enough. I mean, if you talk to him, he'll talk to you at length about pretty much everything except for this one thing. He doesn't like talking about it. But he was seen, there's a video camera in the hallway or the lobby, I should say, of his apartment building. And so he basically, you know, he cut up the body and he just transported it in suitcases and other ways to like this kind of dumpster area outside of the apartment building where he lived, where a few days later, somebody, you know, smelled something awful and they found like a torso. And then he mailed the victim's like hand and a foot to like a political party, a person in a Canadian political party, and also to some grammar schools or middle schools, I can't remember which. With sort of these taunting notes as well.
Is there any understanding of why those specific people were chosen? Or was he trying to throw them off the scent of who he really was by making these kind of weird connections?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, he will claim that he didn't do that. And because he was the only one there, and he claims that he didn't do that, the mailing aspect of anything, it would just be conjecture, like why he actually did that. But I think it was just another way. My guess is just another way for him to build up the press. And he left, he signed the letters, you know, I'm spacing out now on which one it was, but there was a victim of an English serial killer, and he would sign the letters with the name of the victim of the serial killer. So it was all just a kind of a taunting game kind of thing, in my opinion.
And he'll tell you about the murder. Has he admitted to that part of it?
No, that's what I'm saying. He won't. He says a lot of things, and this is in the book, but he says a lot of things where he's basically like, oh, well, you know, all I can say is, you know, no one really knows what happened there. And there's a lot of different things that went on that people don't know about. And he says a lot of things of that nature and kind of glosses over it. Like, he'll talk to me when I talk to him, you know, I'd ask, oh, what was it like, you know, when you were a model? Or what was it like when you were doing this or doing that or this or that? He'll talk a lot, but when it comes down to the actual crimes, he clams right up about those.
And as you're talking about just how horrific this was, the psychiatrist involved in this case actually stepped back from working on the trial because he suffered PTSD from reviewing this case and going over it. Is that right?
There was a, I mean, I, I wish I could speak to that, but I know that the one that I, Dr. Joel Watts was the person that, he did a very exhaustive psychiatric report on Luca. I mean, it's probably like about 150 pages long. And I studied that report. He was the one that ended up testifying for Luca's attorney. So I do not, I wish I could say that that was right, but I'm not 100% sure. So I probably shouldn't speak to that.
All right. How long after the murder did he post this video?
Well, again, he'll say that he didn't. I'm just trying to be clear.
I understand that. I understand.
Yeah, he'll say he didn't, but it was like just within a day or two. And then he ended up, meaning Luca, ended up flying to Europe. And which, again, he'll claim that he didn't even know the police were looking for him. But in theory, like, he was on the run and he was ended up being captured in an internet cafe.
Right. And how long was he on the run for?
Man, it was probably like, it was probably just about a week. It wasn't like all that long of a period of time. It was really, he was named the Canadian Newsmaker of the Year when this happened in 2012. And it was really, it was huge. I mean, especially in Canada, and people were really, really motivated to find him. And when he flew, I mean, he used, you know, his real name, and wasn't like he was looking for him like whatsoever. And, he was just doing his thing. And then he was, you know, he was surprised to see that, like, you know, anyone was looking for him, is what he says. It's really interesting talking to him because it's hard to tell. He was actually arrested in Berlin, but it's hard to tell, like, you know, how much of it is him being dishonest, and how much of it is him actually believing what he's saying. You know, he's definitely not a well guy. I mean, there's.
But when they busted him in Berlin, according to the reports, they busted him surfing the net, reading news stories about him.
And yeah,
how he was, and being, again, sought after.
And I don't mean to, like, none of this is funny, but again, he'll say that he wasn't reading news stories about himself, that he was watching a video and had no idea that anyone was looking for him, and, you know, and so on and so forth.
Did he have any explanation as to how it ended up on his social media page if he had nothing to do with it? And the killer, even though masked, looked remarkably like him.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this person that he talks about a lot by the name of Manny that was involved in his, Manny was the one that made him, was abusive to him and would beat him up and rape him. And Manny was the one that made him hurt the cats. And Manny was in the apartment with him and the victim. And Manny was in charge of this and Manny did that. So I mean, it's an interesting part of the book if anyone reads it, because his mother, Luca's mother, Anna, believes that there is a Manny. You know, I definitely do not believe that. So
could it be said that Luca was dealing with multiple personality disorder, dissociative disorder, and Manny was the aspect of who he
long,
is?
Yeah, so his father was schizophrenic. But and Luca has right. such a long, long history of schizophrenia. He didn't grow up with his father. I mean, you know, but his natural father, is schizophrenic, and Luca has such an incredibly long history of mental illness. You know, hospitalizations, like living in a group home. He was on Canadian's version of welfare because he couldn't, before he started doing sex work, because he couldn't. In theory, he couldn't hold a job because of his mental illnesses. And yeah, I mean, to me, it's a very, 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 very sad story of a man who suffers some pretty severe mental illness, and it went in a very awful direction. And he will say that he's not schizophrenic, and his father's not schizophrenic, and it's ridiculous that anyone thinks that he is.
Right.
Kind of situation.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he goes, he gets caught in Berlin. He's brought back. And, you know, social media, was it Facebook? Was it Twitter at the time? What was he, or not Twitter, Facebook?
He was mostly on Facebook.
Okay. And he posted that. Now, how did people react when that video went up? Were they in disbelief? Did it get reported? I know there have been some of these cases where the videos for some of these violent acts have gone weeks before somebody finally alerts Facebook to say, hey, are you guys aware of this? What was the story?
Yeah, well, no, and he didn't, and that's a good thing to make clear, because when I said he had like 70 or 80 different social media accounts, most of those were on Facebook, but this was not initially posted on Facebook. It was posted, somebody just found it randomly somewhere on it's a site called Kevin666.com, I believe, just some really obscure site. And then it went up on bestgore.com. And that's where the site I was already telling you about that was owned by that man that ended up going to prison for posting it. So it was on Best Gore is like known as a shock website. What they do is they show videos of all sorts of, I mean, it could be execution, it could be gore, all sorts of really, really bizarre things. And that's where the video was posted. And then there was a lot of situation where a lot of people were like, it's got to be fake. This can't be real. You know, video, like, this video cannot be a real video, and so on and so forth. But that was before, you know, the body was found, and then it all sort of tied together, you know, what actually happened.
He's caught in Berlin, brought back. How long does this case go through the court systems, and what all unravels with that?
Well, he had these extensive psychiatric examinations, obviously, because, well, maybe not so obviously, but his attorneys were definitely trying to get him off on, in Canada, it's NCR, which is not criminally responsible. So Lucas says that he never wanted to take that plea, that plea was never anything that he agreed to do, but his lawyer kept telling him, well, this is what we need to do, and so on and so forth. So Dr. Joel Watts came out and said that he was, in fact, you know, suffering from mental illness. He never testified, meaning Luca never testified, at the trial. And the trial itself, I believe, lasted about 10 weeks or so. And he ended up being convicted. I'm trying to like remember the actual length of the sentence, but he was found guilty of murder, and I believe he got 25 years, but it's also 25 years kind of open-ended. It's like a minimum of 25 years. Canada's a little bit different in that sense, but he now resides at a facility called Port Cartier, which is where I've spoken to him and mailed him a few letters so far.
His mother agreed to supply you information to co-write this book. She reconnects with her son after the case is finalized and he's found guilty, or was she reconnecting with him during the case?
Yeah, well, to be honest, it wasn't that she, real quickly, it wasn't that she agreed to supply me information. She was the one that was actually writing the book. I got pulled in to make the book better, so to speak. But she visits him in prison. They talk on the phone all the time. She visits him in prison. She started seeing him again, like after the trial. And they've become close again. Like that's part of the story of the book. I mean, at this point they're very close with each other. And a lot of it is like how much she actually loves her son.
And she believes that he's innocent through this, or does she believe he had a hand in it? He's not completely innocent, but that he wasn't the full monster.
She believes that he's not criminally responsible. I mean, she believes that she doesn't think that he did not do the act. She thinks he's not criminally responsible for the act because of his issues. That's what you know, that's what she thinks. It's not that she thinks he's totally innocent. She's a very nice woman. She's obviously been through a lot. Again, not just because of the murder, but because this case was like, you know, I mentioned Casey Anthony before, but in Canada, this case was like OJ, JonBenet, Casey Anthony. I mean, this is an enormous case for them. So she basically just had media chasing after her and hiding in her trees and, you know, banging on her door for a very, very long period of time. So I think she wrote the book. I'm not trying to speak for her, but just some sort of catharsis to kind of just get out what she experienced and move on with her life.
Well, that's good, I guess, to a degree. Is it hard as a journalist and an author bringing that vibe to the book and dealing with somebody who has a completely cut and dry version of how she believes the story went down or how her son should be looked at? How did you balance that in a book like this to let the reader know that there's more than just her side of this that's going on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And again, that's sort of why I got involved in the book in the first place was, you know, the publisher felt that there needed to be a little more balance to the book. It was hard. I mean, it was definitely a challenge, you know, and even though I'm saying all this stuff about Luca, you know, I talked to the guy a few times. I haven't said this, but he never gave an interview to anybody but me. Like, so since any of this has happened, so, you know, he trusted me to work on his book with his mom, and his mom trusted me. So it was very difficult trying to do that, do a job where Anna, Luca's mother's name is Anna, where Anna, and even to another extent, Luca, you know, that people that were like, okay, we're trusting you to work with us on this, and still, you know, and still not present things like in a rosy manner of like, oh, hey, Luca's a great guy. And none of this, you know, nothing really happened here and so on and so forth. So it's definitely extremely challenging. But I also, you know, as a writer, I appreciated the opportunity to take on a challenge like that. So it was definitely an interesting project as well.
Is it hard to shake that and all the information and the video and the story after you get done doing a book like this? Do you have to go through a clearing process to get you back?
No, I mean, I get what you're saying, and I don't discount that. I think what was hard was when I was actually, the days when I watched the video were a little hard, and then there were a few days that were definitely stressful. But the thing is, you know, I'm a working writer, so I'm off to do, you know, I'm promoting this book, but I'm also doing other things. And I think when you do whatever your job is, if you're doing something that's a little bit odd or dark, I think the thing is you deal with what you just witnessed, and then you just kind of keep going on and do your job and, you know, work in another area and just kind of keep moving on. So, I mean, I think it's a lot harder for Anna. I mean, obviously, than it is for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And when you're putting together to do a book like this and you're talking to the killer, you're talking to the alleged killer, you're talking to his family members and people, what out of all of this, and I mean, it's a disturbing story from start to finish, but what was the most surprising to you through all of this?
Well, I mean, I think if people read the book, the interviews with Luca are rather fascinating. And I was surprised at how consistent he is with the way that he was all along. Like if you hear him, anything you've read about him or anyone's read about him, there's a lot of stuff around there where he'll be like, oh no, well, I didn't actually do this. Other people made this up, and like people were just jealous of me, so they said this about me, and I never had 80 social media accounts, and I never did this. And it was interesting to me how incredibly consistent he is with, you know, with the way that he presents himself and his situation. I mean, he does not waver in his belief in himself. And, you know, he's very now even, he's like, oh, prison's not that bad. And I do all this stuff and I do this and I do that. And, you know, I wasn't expecting necessarily somebody to be, you know, like, oh, I feel really bad about myself or what I did. But it did surprise me that there was almost an incredible, you know, consistency over the last 6 years or so with what he's saying. His story hasn't wavered one little bit. And I think that surprised me.
Do you think he'll be out at the end of his 25 years, or do you think they're going to keep him buried and hidden away, especially because he shows no remorse?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough. I mean, I think it's tough anyway. I mean, you know, again, in America, if you did something like that, you wouldn't be just getting 25 years minimum, you know? So, I mean, I really don't know. I mean, he's such a famous person in Canada. Again, it's funny because you could bring him up in America and a lot of people know who he is, but in Canada, he's really, really famous. So I think it would be difficult for them to release him. I think it would be something that might not be looked at very popularly by the citizenship of that country.
Yeah. Yeah. I would only guess that would almost probably be a death sentence for him.
Right. Well, and that's, yeah, possibly that's true. Yeah. I didn't even think
and not that I'm showing any, and not that I'm showing any, concern for him. I'm just saying, you know, I guess
I know
why they might want to hold him back.
Right.
When kind of looking over the killers and the people that you've written about and talked about, does he rank among the highest of just the most chilling with what he was capable of and the disconnect he seems to have to all of it?
Yeah, I mean, he's confusing. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, what makes him, as we discussed, I mean, what makes him interesting is, you know, even what he did, I mean, which was incredibly horrific, but he did it to somebody that was helpless and tied up, that he sort of tricked into a situation. I mean, he's not the kind of guy that's going to go down the highway, you know, picking up prostitutes and murdering them or anything like that.
Are we sure? You know, I mean, was there any chance that maybe his coup de grace? This was something that he had worked his way up to. Have we ever looked back into his life to see if he had answered any other ads, if there were any other ads he placed, and that those people he connected with? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess no one actually can be sure about something like that. He was a suspect at one point in some murder in Los Angeles. But they cleared him of that. But other than that, I haven't heard of any, but you're right. I mean, when you say, are we sure? I mean, I don't think we can be, you know, but in my background, it's like, you know, I've written a fair amount of books, but really just three that are out now that are completely classified as true crime. And yeah, he's definitely the most frightening guy in that concept that I've worked with, but it's hard when somebody,
that says something too. Okay. He wasn't even related to this person. Casey Anthony, creepy element to examine as well.
Yeah, well, this book, the Casey Anthony book, we have an agent and we're working on it, and we haven't even sent it out to any publishers yet. But yeah, now Casey Anthony she's an entirely different ball of wax than Luca, and that concept of, like, yeah, she's definitely a very scary person, you know, no doubt about it.
I would guess. Do you, you know, when you're not writing books like this, do you take a year or two off between them? Do you, you know, spend a lot of time in adult coloring books or what? I know you get a job, you got to do the job, but again, this seems like it'd be a heavy task. Yeah.
Yeah. It can get a little weird. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I really like the lifestyle. I work at home. I hang out with my dog. You know, so, you know, it's, I think it'd be different if I had to write things like this in an office environment, then I'd probably be out of my skull.
I'd be more concerned that you're at home isolated doing these type of things.
Yeah.
You're going to have to keep a close eye on you, Brian Whitney. I don't want you turning Dexter on us in the future. Here.
Yeah. As long as my girlfriend and I stay together, I'll probably be okay.
Wow, no pressure there. Okay.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
My Son, the Killer, the Untold Story of Luca Magnotta and One Lunatic, One Ice Pick, Brian Whitney. Now, the book, I know it was slated to be out October 30th. It's out and available now, or did you say they pushed it a little bit?
It just came out. It was originally supposed to not come out for another couple months. So it's great that I appreciate the interview. I've got some other stuff going on, but it came out early. So like we weren't quite prepared. We weren't quite prepared for a press blitz. It was supposed to not come out until January. So it is out. It actually just came out on the 6th, which is just yesterday. So it came out yesterday. So this is good timing, and I appreciate it very much.
Not a problem. Thank you for sharing the story with us. And wow, let us know when you're out with your next book. We'd love to chat with you. Tim, let's lighten the mood, man. This is deep, dark, creepy stuff, and I need to shower. But let's start off with a little dumb crime, stupid.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Dumb crimes, stupid criminals, one of our favorite parts of the show, Tim. And, sometimes I do start off with some stories that are a little darker and weirder. We're going to do that now.
Okay.
So, again, if you share this part of the show with your children, but just forewarning you, the next couple of stories are kind of bizarre. A Texas man posted an ad seeking a child, you know, just to try necrophilia and cannibalism with.
Jeez.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, at least it's good that highly idiotic people like this are smart enough to post it so we can find them a lot easier.
Uh-huh.
So you've got to thank that. Texas man who told an undercover Florida sheriff's agent he wanted to rape, kill, and cannibalize a child was arrested as part of a case that was described as one of the most unusual and disgusting ever seen. Alexander Barter, age 21, of Joaquin, posted an advertisement online that read, "I would really like to try necrophilia and cannibalism and see how it feels to take a life," Brevard County Sheriff Wayne Ivey said during a news conference Tuesday. One of the sheriff's deputies, who works with a federal task force, spotted the ad and told Barter he had a child he could provide. "I'd like to do this ASAP," Barter told the undercover agent. "I really need to do something about my intense bloodlust." Barter also allegedly told the agent, I'm not into role playing. I actually want to rape, kill, and cannibalize her. I'm very serious about this. I live in the woods, so I can make sure her body will never be found." The agent traveled to Texas, and Barter was arrested on October 19th. He was taken into custody at his home, which was quite deeply embedded in the woods. During his arrest, Barter was found to have a knife and plastic bags on him to take the body parts in, Ivy said. The sheriff added, Barter thanked investigators for arresting him because he was so committed to carrying out this planned attack. "Barter is one of the most sick, disgusting, and demented people," Ivy told reporters. He was arrested on charges of criminal solicitation, criminal attempt at capital murder, conspiracy to commit capital murder, and criminal attempt at sexual performance of a child. "Obviously, there is no bond, and this individual needs to stay behind bars where he can never harm anyone else," the sheriff has said. Now, I know that I've passed on other stories, and I've told, you know, Tim, we've addressed that, right, when you just send us straight-up child abuse stories.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like to talk about those. This was a case where it didn't happen. But you talk about a dumb crime and a stupid criminal posting it in a public forum like the Weekly Shopper. "Hey, really looking for a kid that I can, eat and have sex with their dead body. If you know of anybody, send them my way." What the hell? But thank God, like I said at the beginning of this, thank God that they're so stupid that in their concept, this was a good idea. Do you think, Tim, in this case, as he said when he was arrested, "Thank you, because I didn't know how to stop this bloodlust." Do you think that he did that on purpose, hoping to be caught?
I think so, yeah. I think he just jeopardized himself so that somebody would catch him, bring him in, and stop him once and for all, yeah.
Beesh. Unbelievable. Creepy.
Very.
And that there's people out there that are thinking that are just like, I wonder what it's like to eat a child. What the hell? Man, I don't know. The world is just getting weirder and weirder by the day, Tim.
I think if there is somebody out there that's listening that's thinking that way, just please, just find a way to either get yourself to a therapist or get yourself some help or find a way to turn yourself in.
Get yourself put in jail so you're safe and away from the real world.
Yeah, find yourself a way to get locked up, whether it be in an institution or a jail. Just
wow.
Yeah.
And there's numbers to call if you want to hurt yourself or hurt others. Call and talk to somebody. Get it out. Get, you know, sometimes just venting it and getting the thoughts out or writing it out and then burning it to just give it away. Oh, good grief. Ugh. All right. Our next story, also a little weird and dark. We're going to North Attleboro, Tim. A New Jersey mental health therapist hired an undercover agent posing as a hitman to beat a local man and disfigure his face, allegedly because he bilked her out of money over a period of years, according to federal prosecutors. Diane Silva, 58, of Summers Point, New Jersey, wanted the unnamed local man's pretty little face bashed in and added a broken arm would help, too, according to an FBI affidavit filed in the U.S. County District Court in Camden, New Jersey. Sylvia, a clinical social worker who operates an office in Lynnwood, New Jersey, appeared in court Monday and is free on $50,000 unsecured bond. Neither she nor her attorney could be reached by the Sun Chronicle for comment Wednesday. She faces one count of solicitation to commit a crime of violence for allegedly paying an undercover FBI agent posing as a hitman $5,000 to carry out the assault. Tim would have done it for $50 and a McRib. What the hell's wrong with people?
Well, two McRibs. Let's not go cheap here. I mean,
you know. It's true. Yeah. By the way, McRib's back in Minnesota. Thank you, McDonald's.
Oh, yeah.
In a bizarre scene straight out of the HBO hit The Sopranos, Sylvia was counseling a former member of an organized crime gang and asked him in September to conspire to kill the North Attleboro man, according to the affidavit. She allegedly later told the patient she wanted to just permanently disfigure the man's face, according to the affidavit. The man told Sylvia of his past gang affiliations and prior associates, the affidavit states. Instead of carrying out her plan, the patient contacted the FBI. Then introduced the undercover officer to Sylvia as the hitman. Meetings with the undercover officer during which she made the alleged proposal were audio and video recorded, and she also texted the agent, according to the affidavit. All he has is like big muscles and a cute face, Sylvia allegedly said, adding she wanted him to have a bashed-in face that's not going to get better, the affidavit states. Sylvia said her intended victim was a con man who bilked her out of an unspecified amount of money. She allegedly said he ended up with some stuff on me and threatened to report her to the licensing board and threaten her career, according to the affidavit. When asked how assaulting this man would help Sylvia, she allegedly replied, "It's just going to make me feel better. And it's the only way I can get him back," the affidavit states. If convicted, Sylvia faces up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. So obviously she must have had sex with him as a patient.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and wanted him back. So if he's horribly disfigured, nobody else would want him. So then she could get him and take care of him.
That's bizarre logic.
Cuckoo in the nut-nut, as my mom would say.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Tim, when you think baby shower and gifts, you know, it can be an overwhelming task.
Sure.
What do you pick? What's the best kind of gift? And for God's sakes, the most important thing is which store is best to shoplift that gift from? Well, we're going to Peoria, Illinois, Tim, where a woman was caught stealing baby clothes. A weeping Walmart shopper said she had no other way to provide a gift for her sister's baby shower, police said. Security at Walmart at 3315 North University Street alerted Peoria police regarding a theft in progress at 1:20 p.m. Saturday. Security had stopped the woman, caught trying to leave without paying for several items of baby clothes stuffed into a bag, according to a Peoria police report. Sobbing to police, she admitted the attempt theft. She was going to her sister's baby shower and had no money to buy a gift and didn't want to be the only one to show up without a gift, the report stated. She was given a notice to appear in court on account of misdemeanor theft. Now, that's neither dumb nor stupid.
No.
And the reason I included this story is that this does affect a lot of people. You know, you want to give, you want to be a part of this, and you don't want to feel like you're on the cheap. Well, here's a couple of concepts you might want to do. A, avoid the baby shower. B, what if you just tell that person, "I love you with all my heart, and I know you're going to get inundated with clothes and diapers and all types of things. What I'd like to do is be there to help you. So if you need a break or somebody to come over and spend the night to feed the baby for a few nights so you can get a full night of rest, I would like to offer my services." That would be, to most moms, the best gift you could ever give.
Sure.
Sure. And to those dads, too, that are just maybe not good at getting up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But honestly, helping a new mother deal with the baby and giving them a break during the day to get some sleep in, or coming over and helping to clean the house, maybe make some meals that they could put away and freeze. Those gifts are just as important as the materialistic gifts that, you know, we give. So, you know, if you find yourself in a bind out there, folks, don't become one of our dumb crime, stupid criminals. Try to think outside the box. Truly, the best gift is something that you can give of yourself.
Let me ask you this, too. If you're in that Walmart at that time and you see that lady being arrested for trying to shoplift a baby gift, do you step in at that point? And let's just say it's a, what was the dollar amount on it? Was it like $15?
It didn't say.
Okay.
A couple
baby outfits are what, probably $30-$40 at Walmart?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you step in and pay for it? And see if Walmart will waive the charges?
Yes, but here's the problem. I know some security people that work at Target and Walmart,
mm-hmm.
and they spirit away people pretty quickly. So if they know that you've busted, they'll grab you before you head out the door or right after, and then they bring you back into security office where they call the police. So in most cases, you and I as a casual observer at Walmart and Target would have no idea what just happened. So we might see them bringing a crying woman in, but we don't hear the story.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, certainly. If that was the case and I heard somebody crying that they wanted to just provide these gifts and they had no way to do it, I would offer. Let me take care of that for her.
Yeah.
It's my fault. I told her I was going to give her the money and then told her I wasn't. I was joking. She thought I was being serious and she was caught between a rock and a hard place. If anybody should go to jail today, it should be me for playing a game like that. Here, let me just pay for it. Can you drop the deal? I would do whatever it took to get her out of it.
Sure.
If you heard that story up front. But I don't think most of us get that chance to know. And I do know that there have been a few security guards and agents that I know personally who have dug deep into their own pockets after hearing a true story like this,
mm-hmm.
and have ponied up the cash to take care of it so that they could have a gift or have food to take home to their kids that night, or work something out with them. So I do know that there are some, but in some cases, they also have a job to do and they have to follow through. And once you've committed to a certain level and police have been alerted, there's really nothing you can do as a security guard. You kind of got to let protocol follow through.
True. And you can't pony up for everybody who has an excuse. I know that too.
Right.
But
right.
You know what really breaks
my heart? My daughter worked at Target,
mm-hmm.
and when they would have power outages, their freezers were good for X amount of time, like the backup generators. And then after that, they would just have to bring in these dumpsters and they would throw out all the food.
Ooh.
Instead of contacting local food shelves.
Yeah.
Legally, and this is a law that definitely needs to be looked into, because you talk about a dumb crime. They would throw away thousands of pounds of food.
Oh, my gosh.
That could have been used that night at shelters, but it's because it's thawed out. It has to be cooked immediately that day, and they have no way to guarantee that it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they would just, they have to discard it. I don't know why then you don't, you know, as a tax write-off, you've got insurance on the food.
Mm-hmm.
As a tax write-off, why wouldn't you just contact local shelters and say, here, we've prepared, and just, you know, make a bunch of these meals and have them delivered so that they could be frozen or something,
right?
After they've been cooked and made, so that way they've got them on hand. But the real crime in that is, man, they're throwing away hundreds of thousands of dollars of groceries.
Yeah.
Thousands of pounds of food that went from frozen state to refrigerated state. And well, it's better to just throw it out than to feed the people. That we have a real breakdown in our society with the way that we handle things like that. And you know what? You're right. Because you can't refreeze the thawed food.
Mm-hmm.
You give the food that, help feed the homeless and starving that night. And then, you know, the rest gets dumped. At least do something to that level.
Yeah.
You know, but that they open themselves up to legal recourse. I know I'm already hearing the emails coming my way, but if they get that food and for some reason they get sick because it thawed out and they didn't cook it properly, they can sue Walmart or Target. I do know that's the case. And that's sad too, you know, and in some of those cases, maybe there's a waiver that's signed that
that's
if you
right.
take this food, it is with
waiver.
The understanding that this is what happened.
Yep. It's called a waiver. Get you out of here.
As long as we're in Peoria, Tim.
Yep.
Shall we share another fun tale from Peoria?
Sure.
A beer-fueled argument ended with a man stabbed in the face on the East Bluff, according to Peoria police. About 8:15 p.m. Sunday, police were called to a residence at the 1900 block of North California Avenue. On a sidewalk, a 39-year-old man clutched a rag to his face over a stab wound. The report said a 31-year-old man stood on the home's porch, his head and face covered with blood. Police later determined the blood had come from the victim. To police, the 31-year-old pointed out a small pocket knife on a table inside the house. He said he had used the knife after the other man attacked him, the report said. However, the resident of the house told another story. Four men had been inside drinking beer when the 31-year-old took the 39-year-old's can of beer. When the latter protested, the other man squeezed the can and spewed beer all over the 39-year-old's face. The older man pushed away the other man, and then the two began to grapple. The resident said he could only witness parts of the clash as it was dark in the house because he currently has no electricity. The report said, however, the resident saw the younger man punch the other in the head repeatedly. The report said outside, the resident realized the victim had been stabbed multiple times in the head. The report stated the 31-year-old was booked on account of aggravated battery. He was released from the Peoria County Jail on his own recognizance. Does that sound unnerving to you? I'm mad enough over a beer, I'm going to stab you in the head repeatedly with a knife, and then I'm just going to get let out on my own recognizance?
There is no beer out there that's worth stabbing somebody in the head for. I'm sorry.
It depends on how hot it is outside, honestly. I mean, if a nice ice cold beer might be worth it, Tim.
Nah.
No?
No. All right. No.
Well, how about if we follow up beer with potato chips, Tim?
Okay.
We're sticking in Peoria because that's where all the action apparently is taking place. A man accused of stealing a 50-cent bag of potato chips from a South Peoria service station was arrested after he body slammed an employee, according to police. The incident happened shortly after 10 p.m. Saturday at a Shell station. A report stated arrested was Torlando Smith, Tim Torlando.
Torlando, you say?
Whose home address wasn't available. He was booked at the Peoria County Jail on charges of aggravated battery and retail theft, according to a report. A service station employee told the police Smith grabbed a bag of cheddar ruffle potato chips and left the store without paying, the report said. The employee followed Smith outside to confront him. Both men returned to the store, where Smith twice threw the employee to the ground, according to the report. A review of surveillance video indicated the two men exchanged shoves. The report stated the employee attempted to turn and walk away, but Smith threw him over his back at least once. Boy, I beat your ass, Smith was quoted in the report as saying on video. Afterwards, Smith told police he paid for the chips. The employee swung at him first, and he slammed himself in defense. The report stated the officer told Smith the video did not support those claims. Yeah, so some body slamming going on, Tim.
Well, if he threw him over his back, technically that would be a suplex, not a body slam.
Is that what it is? Wow, yeah, wow, look at you.
Yeah, just saying.
You and your wrestling terminology. So here's another story for you to consider then, Tim.
Okay.
So you work for a convenience store, and somebody grabs a 50-cent bag of potato chips and takes off with them.
Well, here's, you know, now you said
do you just reach into your pocket and go, you know what? Not worth it, and just throw 50 cents in that drawer? Or do you go, hey, stop, ne'er-do-well. Those are chips you have not yet paid for.
Well, here's
go
where
out there
I,
and try to
I gotta,
stop them.
I got to call time out here. You said those were Ruffles.
Uh-huh.
Ruffles have ridges, Dave, and there is no such thing as a 50-cent bag of Ruffles out there. They're generally around $1.99 for the little bags.
Not in Peoria, Tim, where people get stabbed in the face for one beer. There's a difference here. Here's the thing I really want to know. I wish they would tell us in the story if this guy was held on bond. Because all this guy did was steal a 50-cent bag of chips and throw a guy to the floor twice. The other guy squeezed a beer in his buddy's face and then proceeded to stab him repeatedly in the head and was released on his own recognizance.
If it is a 50-cent bag of chips, Dave, that's 25 cents a slam.
Well worth it. But seriously, would you chase somebody down for a 50-cent bag of chips, knowing in this world that that person may be nuts, may have a gun, a knife, a bowl whip, I don't know, can of mace? Would you go after him for 50 cents?
If I got a hankering to lay a smackdown on that day, sure. But no, I would not. I don't think I'm chasing anybody for 50 cents. No.
Yeah. I don't think nobody needs to be that big a hero. Just reach into those, penny jar.
Well, here's the thing.
And if somebody needs food that bad that they need to steal a 50-cent bag.
I've, I've cashed
chips. Just let them have it.
I've cashiered before at convenience stores. First of all, there is such a thing as a loss quotient at your store. Second of all, even if you were short on your drawer, 50 cents isn't going to get you fired.
No,
just saying.
Well, but here's the whole deal. It wasn't like he rang up and then ran out of the store. They wouldn't even know that the 50 cents went missing on your your watch. Yeah,
right.
I'd leave it be. I'd leave it be. I'd kick in that 50 cents out of the goodness of my heart. I'd be like, you know what? I got 50 cents in the couch cushions at home that I can know when to help feed this fella a bag of chips. Let him have it. Although, I guess the term is, you know, how many times has this guy been in that has maybe shoplifted those bag of chips before and this was just your final straw?
That's right. Maybe he had it coming.
Well, he didn't get body slammed. The guy that stopped him got body slammed.
Well, but maybe today was the day. That's all he could stand. He couldn't stand no more, and it was time for some cashier ass kicking. You know what I'm saying?
Cashier justice.
Yeah, well, CJ. Yeah, cashier justice. Yeah, so he decided he was going to throw off the smock and time to give a little cashier rock, if you know what I'm saying.
I guess.
And so he tied on the Hulkamania bandana, and hulked up a little bit and came out from behind the counter and got the whooping of a lifetime.
Tim, I've got this next story.
Okay.
And I don't know if I should leave it as the last story or... No, I'm gonna read it now, and then we can close out with two different stories that kind of tie into our other world.
Okay.
Our listeners crack me up, the stories they send me, Tim. I don't know. I wonder if this is a Bill Curtis style story, Tim.
All right.
Police arrest man for allegedly having sex with a dying beaver while high on methamphetamine. A 35-year-old Washington man was arrested over the weekend for allegedly having intercourse with a dying beaver while high on the drug methamphetamine, reports the Washington television station KXLY. Don't bother pinching yourself. Yes, this is real life. It started around 9 p.m. when a local woman came across a beaver that had been struck by a car. Someone help me save this beaver, she wrote in a Facebook post. I flipped him over so he would walk, but his leg is broken.
Aww.
She was able to move the beaver, but out of the way of traffic, by placing it on a towel and dragging it closer to a nearby pond. After calling local wildlife agencies, the veterinary clinics that were closed for the holiday weekend, she decided to run home and grab a plastic tub that she could keep the animal in until authorities were open the following day.
Hmm.
When she came back, she had a rather unsightly surprise. He's deceased, she wrote in the comments. I caught a homeless man having sex with a dead beaver. I'm traumatized. Officers with the Kennewick Police Department confirmed the account, saying in a statement they responded to a report of a transient male having sexual contact with a wild animal. The man was contacted by police and also found to be in possession of suspected methamphetamine. He's facing a charge of animal cruelty and possession of a controlled substance, methamphetamine. Both of which are felonies. If convicted for animal cruelty, he could face a 2-year jail sentence, a fine starting at $1,000, and forfeiture of any animals he owns, plus a ban on having similar pets in the future, reports Newsweek. Naturally, the report got the WTF wheels turning. Why in the world would someone want to have sex with an animal? Bestiality, also known as zoophilia, is actually still legal in several countries and in a handful of U.S. states. Classified as a psychological order, it's actually a lot more common than you might think. Reuters reports that 17% of vets think they've treated an animal that has been sexually assaulted by a human. What's so appealing about our furry friends? Believe it or not, scent. A whopping 89% of zoophiles said a musky smell was a key attraction when it came to picking out an animal partner, reports Vice. For others, it's the notion that sex with an animal is taboo and violates social standards. Then again, meth makes people do some pretty damn weird things. I'm Bill Curtis, and I'm out of here, bitches.
What the hell?
All right, can I build a defense for the homeless guy for a second?
Oh, I don't know that you should. You know how people feel about their animal cruelty, my friend.
I know.
I'd like to now turn this section of the show over to Tim Dennis. Please send all mail to Tim at darknessradio.com. Tim, you have the floor.
Maybe, just maybe, the beaver was still alive when he got there. And maybe, just maybe, he had Dr. Doolittle-like powers. And maybe, just maybe, in that last moment of that beaver's life, that beaver looked that homeless man in the eye and said, "Listen, I know you're riding the snake right now. And I know things may be going good for you, but they're not so good for me, my friend. And maybe, just maybe, you could do me one last favor before I kick this mortal coil."
So wait, you're thinking said beaver was a virgin and didn't want to go out that way.
Exactly!
Hey, listen. Here's the problem. I'm about to check out, and I've never had the sex. So if you could just do me this favor, just give me a little loving, some tender, tender loving.
That's what the beaver, you think, in Dr. Doolittle language was telling said methed out homeless man.
Could have been.
And being a kind-hearted humanitarian, he thought to himself, how could I not help this poor beaver lose his virginity before his untimely death?
Exactly.
Tim, you might need help. Might need help.
I'm just saying, we don't know. We weren't there.
I'm pretty sure we do, Jim, that's not and never will be the case. All right, let's take it from the plain out strange to the even stranger, Tim. We've got two stories that dabble into the realm of the supernatural. Ooh. As we wrap up today's episode. And speaking of wrapping up today's episode, as you remember, folks, I promised an extra episode this month. Mm-hmm. We're delivering this Thursday. You'll be able to check out another brand new episode. It is the true crime portion only. It won't be dumb crime, stupid criminals. The Kill Jar: Obsession, Descent, and a Hunt for Detroit's Most Notorious Serial Killer. J. Reuben Appleman, our guest, in what is probably one of the more personal and interesting stories. We talk about the case, but the connection J. Reuben Appleman has and the effect that it had on him is very compelling. And this story becomes a much more personal tale, listening to Jay discuss the case and the deep implications and how it affected and impacted his life. It is one of the more disturbing in the sense of personal psychological effect of a story. We've talked to many authors through the years asking about how writing a story like this impacts them. And many come from it at a journalistic point where they remain objective. But I think because our guest was so closely affected by this story and was nearly abducted himself, we enter kind of a different realm. So that's the episode we're going to give you this week as an additional episode. I think it's fascinating, and it really gives a different insight and look into the effects of these type of stories have not only on the public, but on people that grew up in that era and may have been impacted by the story, and then dig deeper and uncover what could be a very creepy and very disturbing conspiracy behind it. So that will be our additional episode as a little Thanksgiving gift from your buddies here at True Crime Tuesday. So make sure you check that out, and that'll be out this Thursday. Is that right, Tim? Thursday?
Yeah, Thursday. Yep.
Okay, so you get this episode today and another episode on Thursday, and then we'll be back with you next Tuesday with another brand new edition of True Crime Tuesday, plus Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. All right, our final two stories for today, Tim. A hairdresser has been arrested for making voodoo dolls from customers' hair.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Now, this is one of those kind of stories, Tim. I'm gonna shoot you this story right now.
Okay.
I you know, here's the main thing. You know me. I don't want to judge on people's looks.
Sure.
But I don't think I would trust this guy with a razor or sharp implements around my hair to begin with. Take a quick look at his mugshot.
Oh, my. Hmm.
Am I being too judgy-wudgy?
Yeah, maybe.
No, I don't think so. You know what? You could be my gas station attendant. You could be my postman.
Wow.
I don't want you near sharp implements by my head or face.
You said postman. I don't know that I'd let him near my house to deliver my mail.
Oh, see? So I'm judgy-wudgy. A hairdresser from New Orleans was arrested and accused of using his customers' hair to create voodoo dolls and cast curses upon them. This is an interesting story, Tim, and we're going to have to dig deeper into this. We may have to do an episode of Beyond the Darkness on this, because according to the New Orleans Police Department, a 29-year-old Enoch Azaka collected the hair he cut from his customers at the Old City Barbershop and used it in black magic rituals. New Orleans Police Chief Ronel Serpas says Mr. Azaka used his skills as a voodoo sorcerer to cause pain and illness to his victims in order to extort money and sexual favors. The victims, describing suffering from acute migraines, back pain, severe rashes, respiratory problems, and even some sudden and eerie hemorrhages that would cause blood to come out of their eyes, nose, and ears. Mr. Azaka allegedly contacted them himself to explain that he was a powerful sorcerer and caused their pain. Two of the female customers claim that instead of money, the accused asked them for sex in exchange for dispelling the curses he had cast on them. Enoch Azaka now faces a total of 184 criminal charges, including 94 charges of theft, 32 charges of extortion, and 48 charges of witchcraft. Witchcraft and the practice of magical arts are still illegal in Louisiana under an old French law that predates the state's acquisition by the United States in 1803. The 1731 Act Against Sorcery and Witchcraft provides that anyone who should use, practice, or exercise any witchcraft enhancement, charm, or sorcery shall be sentenced to a minimum of 10 years of imprisonment. If found guilty on all charges, Mr. Azakia could get a fine of $1,125,000 and face a total of 835 years of imprisonment. He was freed a few hours after his arrest on $120,000 bail and should be back in court for the beginning of his trial.
So I got a question. So, okay. So he wasn't doing this for money. He was doing it for sex.
No, no, no. Some he wanted money. Some he wanted sex.
Okay.
Yeah, it says that he used his skills as a voodoo sorcerer to cause pain and illness to his victims in order to extort money and sexual favors. So from the gals, in order to lift said curse, you had to come do the dirty bop with him. And for the others, they had to pay this. Now, so an interesting aspect, because if you're going to do this and you're going to put him away for this, you now have to prove that voodoo and black magic exist. This could be a precedent-setting court case.
It could. I have another question. Where was he when the beaver died?
You disturb me in more and more ways on a daily basis.
I'm just curious.
How weird, though. Tim, I mean, the implication, seriously, we got to talk to Mark Anthony, the attorney, on this and find out. I mean, the implications, you would have to prove black magic exists. Now, you can extort and tell people, I've done this to you, and I want money or sex. And I don't know wherein, if that's a crime, because you'd have to prove that you actually did those things. This is the Dave Schrader defense attorney at law part of me.
Okay.
But I'm not so quick to jump to his aid because it's creepy as fuck. And if people are bleeding from the eyes, ears, and noses after this guy gives you a haircut, how many times do you go to him for a haircut?
You mean you'd go back?
Did the courts really go back to a law that was on the books back in 1730? You know, I don't. Part of the story just reads as complete and utter bullshit to me. And the other side is it's just creepy as all get out.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around you go back. That's
right. Well, he gives a hell of a haircut, and I like the massage afterwards.
Ah, yeah, I see.
Huh. Satanists are all up in arms, Tim.
Oh no.
Yeah, they're suing Netflix and Warner Brothers for $150 million. All right. Without giving you any information more.
All right.
Why would Satanists sue Netflix and Warner Brothers for $150 million? Because the next sentence, I'm pretty sure you never thought would ever come out of anybody's mouth in the history of crime.
My guess, it has to do with they were being portrayed wrong on some program.
To a degree, yes.
Okay.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Satanists are suing Netflix and Warner Brothers for $150 million, saying Sabrina copied their statue, Tim.
No, no.
Just months after a statue of Baphomet grabbed national headlines while briefly appearing outside the Arkansas state capitol, the winged goat-headed creature has stepped back into the spotlight, this time taking its starring turn in the courts. The Satanic Temple has sued Netflix and Warner Brothers in a New York federal court alleging that media giants lifted and misused its distinctive icon. The organization filed a complaint Thursday saying its copyrighted statue design known as Baphomet with Children appeared without its permission in The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, a new streaming series released on Netflix last month. The temple claims that by doing so, the company's committed copyright infringement, violated its trademark, and injured the organization's business reputation. Is that possible?
No.
All told, it is demanding the relief on the order of more than $150 million. Among other things, TST, the Satanic Temple, designed and commissioned the TST Baphomet with Children to be a central part of its efforts to promote First Amendment values of separation of church and state and equal protection. The complaint explains defendants' prominent use of the symbol as the central focal point of the school associated with evil, cannibalism, and murder blurs and tarnishes the TST Baphomet with Children as a mark of TST. When contacted for comment, Netflix referred NPR's request to Warner Brothers, which in turn declined to offer a statement. The Satanic Temple arguments hinges largely on a side-by-side comparison of the two images. Both feature a young boy and a girl gazing admiringly at the seated deity, which has two fingers raised to the sky as it stares straight ahead. What's more, the plaintiff notes that unlike previous depictions, the Sabrina version uses an exposed male chest instead of exposed large, voluptuous female boobs, the characteristic the Satanic Temple claims to be its own original contribution. Temple co-founder and spokesperson Lucian Greaves presented the two versions together in a tweet earlier this week for purposes of comparison. And, okay, obviously they're ripping off the image. There's no doubt about it. When you see the original statue and the statue, there's no doubt that Sabrina's using it. The statue may look familiar, and not just for Sabrina viewers. Back in August, the Satanic Temple made a national splash with its protest of a Ten Commandments monument that had been installed on Arkansas State Capitol grounds earlier in the year. The temple and other groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, decried the move as violating the separation of church and state. In reaction to the Ten Commandments monument, the temple hauled out its own 7.5-foot statue to take up residence on the state grounds, and it held a rally to celebrate the short-lived installation. It came down after just a handful of hours. Now, the Satanic Temple is girding for a new fight, saying the series has twisted its publicly espoused tenets, which it says calls for compassion and empathy, the struggle for justice, and conforming beliefs to one's best scientific understanding of the world, among other principles. The series, on the other hand, implies the monument stands for evil. The complaint states, and now the temple is demanding redress in trial by jury. Interesting. That Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Tim, is now in the headlines because of a legal suit for using a demonic statue incorrectly. You just can't write this stuff. You can't make it up. It's all true. That's it for this week's brand new edition of True Crime Tuesday. I hope you guys enjoyed it and had some fun with us. Remember, Thursday, we've got a special edition episode, The Kill Jar, Obsession, Descent, and a Hunt for Detroit's most notorious serial killer. That's J. Reuben Appleman, our special guest on Thursday's additional episode, another brand new episode of True Crime Tuesday. You get a full one-hour episode, sans the dumb crime, stupid criminals. But we will be back next week with another brand new edition of True Crime Tuesday, plus dumb crime, stupid criminals. Thank you for being a part of our world. We'll see you again next week right here on the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is True Crime Tuesday.